Thanks, Jason. My name's Remy. I'm a recovering addict.
Hey, Remy.
Everybody can hear?
Yes.
At the back there? Good, 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 good. Yeah, I'm a recovering addict. Yeah, a day at a time. It's kind of weird, isn't it? When was it going to... You know, like, if there's all this, and you're kind of waiting. It's like waiting to come out of the trap and go for it, and... I'm out now, so let's give it a go. Thank you for your share. Lovely. It was a lovely share. And I'm not just saying that it was a lovely share. And I was thinking how I've ended up here. I saw Gary at the London convention, and I says, when are you going to invite me back to share at your meeting? You know. And of course, in some circles, asking to share is not the done thing. You know, you're supposed to get an invitation. But I don't, you know, I think, what the... Hey, man, I truly believe, you know, I've got a message to carry, man. I'm enthusiastic about this, you know, so, you know, I'll invite myself. Why not? You know, and that ain't my ego speaking. I'm passionate about this, man, you know. You know, and on the other hand, I'm not always, and I don't adhere to that if somebody asks me to share, that I've got to share because I'm an NA member. You know, the fact is that sometimes I'm not able to share, you know. When I first came around, yeah, I'd jump at it, snap at it, you know, yeah, I'm going to share, yeah, you know. But nowadays, life is life, and I'm a bit older in the tooth, you know, and I've got a certain amount of energy, and sometimes I can't make it when invited to share somewhere, you know. So that's how I ended up here anyway. Gary texted me in the weekend, asked me if I'd share, and I said, yeah. And here I am, because I was coming in London for some other NA business, and it's good to be here, and I really like this meeting. I was here about 3 years ago, and it was probably about... I remember coming here about 5 years ago and thinking, why aren't they asking me to share, you know? Because, you know, the ego gets the better of us and thinks, you know, I want to be up there, I want to be talking, you know. And the funny thing was, the first three meetings I came to, I was kind of working in London at the time. I was living in Western Super, where I lived up until January, and I was coming down and sitting out there. And the first 3 weeks I came here on the Friday, I was kind of like, I didn't know that many people, because I'd got clean in London, and then I relapsed, and then I moved to Western. And so coming back, you kind of have this expectation that you're going to see all your peers from back in the day, and of course that isn't always the case. And I kind of sit there, you know, and kind of try and be cool, and not try and get my, let my head say, you know, don't they know who I am, and how come they're not hugging me, and, you know, and there's the other part of me thinking, well, how about you hugging somebody, you know, how about you stepping up, you know, but of course, you know, when I'm in that state, you know, I want you to come to me, I don't want to come to you. And the first 3 weeks, three of my peers from when I got clean in 1992, 93, were sharing week after week after week, which is really good, you know, because the fact is that people don't stick around. For whatever reason, they don't stick around. You know, and you know, whatever you want to think about that, you know. You know, I like to think that everybody sticks around. I like to think everybody's well and they're not using and they're kind of carrying their spiritual awakening somewhere else. I hope they are, you know, because it says, you know, in the 12 step, you know, we practiced this stuff in all our affairs, you know, so hopefully they're out there doing it elsewhere, you know, but that's just my little rant for the moment, so. So what am I going to talk about? I ain't got a clue. You know, and I think that's the thing about this. I brought me it worked how and why. And I got this in 1993 when I was in a treatment facility. It was brand spanking new. It was hot off the press. There weren't many copies around. And I wanted to be different because they were giving out basic texts when, of course, I want to be different, like a good old addict that I am. And all the people from the treatment facility, the staff, didn't want the residents, I wanted the staff to sign it, and they all signed it. So you can see it's kind of well-worn, and it's had its day, and it's well-marked, and I'm probably not going to read anything out of it, so don't worry, so, you know, because you might get a bit frightened, and I'm going to get too technical, and too deep, and too recovery-orientated, but it's good stuff. If you haven't got one, get one, because it's done me well. You know... you were saying it was your second chance or your second bite at recovery. This where I'm sitting right now is my third bite. My first chance or grasping for trying to stop taking drugs and getting clean was in 1989, and I, you know, I went off some. I went to the Citizens Advice Bureau, and hey man, I can't. I come from a West Indian community. Nobody ever said they had problems. Nobody ever said they couldn't cope with what was going on. But I got to a point where I couldn't cope with what was going on, and I wanted help. And I never kind of had it with people who were taking heroin or injecting or anything like that. So I didn't know that there were things like street agencies, and didn't know, you know. But I knew that if I went to the Citizens Advice Bureau, they'd tell me something. And they made me aware of street agencies. And I went to a street agency, and back then, not many people were taking crack. people were taking it, but they weren't messed up. You know, I'd kind of started some years prior to that freebasing. And I had more money than I had sense, and I was with a group of other guys, and we was all partying and having a good time, and, you know, and it was all good fun. You know, it was all clean, above board, you know, decent. You know, but even then, you know, there was always that, well, can't we just get another gram? Yeah, but it's like six in the morning. Yeah, but, you know, even then, I was in trouble. But, you know, the other people weren't in trouble. They got it all sorted. I wish they had, but they hadn't. But, and so anyway, I went to this place, and they was as lost as me. They didn't have a clue what to do, you know, because they couldn't give me methadone. There wasn't Subutex back then, so they didn't know what to do. So they suggested that I go to rehab. And I thought, okay, what's rehab? And they described it as a place, a leafy green place in the countryside, and da-da-da-da-da-da. I said, okay, and how long will I be there? And they said, back in those days, you just picked up the phone, and you said, you got a bed, and you was off, and you could stay there for up to 2 years. You know. I thought that was a little bit over the top. I know I got a problem, but 2 years. I was there 18 months. Sad thing was, I didn't get clean. That was a sad thing. They had this policy that when you were in the second phase of the program, that they suggested if you didn't have an alcohol problem, that you could have a drinking diary where you would have start off with 6 units and work up to 12 units. Well, and of course I didn't drink. I didn't have a relationship with alcohol. Well, I didn't think I did anyway. You know. So the bottom line was I left there in as much not quite as much trouble as when I got there. You know, I learnt some skills there. You know, it was kind of those old draconian places where they supposedly pulled you apart and then left you. pretense of putting you back together. But the sad thing, funny thing was, I've moved from Western Supermare to Birmingham, and two or three weeks ago, I went down with a couple of friends to pick up some stuff to take back there. And I've rented out now, but I've still got my pictures up. I've got like a notice board with photographs on me. And one of my friends took a picture of these people, me, with dreadlocks, believe it or not. I had dreadlocks. And some other people, and he posted it on Facebook. But the sad thing was about it was me and three other people, and those three other people are dead. You know, that's the sad thing about it. And so many people died from going into that treatment facility, because the reality was that a lot of the people who were running that particular facility didn't understand addiction and didn't have a real clue. It was one of those kind of graduate programs where you kind of graduate through the program, and then you kind of look, maybe 6 months later you were sitting in group and taking the group, you know, and that's how it was run, and a lot of people died, and it was quite sad really, you know. And they were all kind of, the three people in there with me were mixed race like me. You know, two were from Manchester and one was from Liverpool. And they're no longer with us because they died to this disease. And no doubt everybody has a story similar to that, you know, whether it's home, on the street, treatment facilities. That's the reality, you know. We're the lucky ones. We're here. You know, we got the opportunity. In reality, most people don't get this. You know, and if they do get it, they don't keep it. They give it away, or they lose it, or whatever you want to call. You know, that's the sad thing about this illness. You know, so my progression was that I left there and found myself using. Bottom line is, I kind of left there with a diploma in social and community care. That was the good thing. That's put me in good stead for employment further down the line. But at that, you know, and I say the crazy thing was about it was that I was even using. They kind of grabbed onto me because I did a placement at this agency. It was up in Sheffield, it was, and they were desperate to get somebody black on board to kind of address their black problems in the black community. And of course, I put my hand up. You know, yeah, I'll do that. You know, because like any good addict, we can solve other people's problems quicker than we're our own. And the bottom line was, next thing you know, I was working in there. I was working in there and I was solving other people's problems, but I was in trouble myself. I was running around, smoking weed, having the occasional rock, and a little bit of alcohol, trying to hold it down. But of course, you know, once the rock took hold, it was gone, it was over. And then, even more bizarrely, I went for another interview with another agency, and I got a job working out in Jamaica, solving other people's problems. You know, they flew me out there, they paid, what's the name? But 2 days before I was to go, I ended up robbing the agency. Like a good addict, I robbed the agency, smoked the electrical goods, came in the next morning, sat at my desk, and the police came in, dusting for fingerprints. You know, I was like, it was touch and go, and the only thing that saved me was I was able to get on that plane and go to Jamaica. And the funny thing was, I didn't use in Jamaica, well, I didn't use crack and I didn't use weed. I just kind of, every weekend, we'd kind of have a little bit of alcohol, a little bit of white rum, get legless and stagger back to the rehab. And I kind of did that for 6 months, and that kept me instead. And then when I came back, there's another little story tied in there. So that was the first place I was introduced to NA, because some of the people in the facility were going to NA meetings. And again, like a good addict, I knew nothing about NA, but I had an opinion. And I was telling them that they shouldn't be going there because blah, 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 blah. I can't even remember what my excuse was. And I kind of had to go back and make an amends to that facility. And I did, I went back and made amends because I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. Sad, but I didn't know. And maybe it was fear, maybe. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. But anyway, I found myself back in England, 1992, wandering around between Sheffield, Manchester, Birmingham, London. You know, lost, using intermittently. And I was in London one day, and two people came up to me from my past and said, two ladies, and said they'd just come out of rehab and... they went to these meetings, and at that point, I was desperate. I was selling posters on the street, which was, people know me from back in the day, used to come to the meetings with me posters under my hand, and do the meeting, then down to Soho and in the West End and sell posters. So I was selling posters on the street, but at that time, and they said they were going to these meetings. At that point, I didn't have a social circle. I didn't have any friends. I had one friend, and he was putting me up down in Deptford in his store cupboard, and that's where I was living, in the store cupboard with the posters, and quite sad really. And I was getting this money, and you know, anybody who knows, money equals crack, crack equals money, money crack money, and I was hanging on for dear life, you know. And what I'd do is I'd tell him I was going up to see my family in Birmingham, and I'd go up to Birmingham and I'd smoke crack and I'd come back potless, and he'd say, "What was that? What happened to your money?" Or "Give it to my kids." Or "I'll give it to somebody," you know. And eventually, it all got too much, and I went to that. I went to my first meeting, June 1992, and it was I don't think it's there anymore. Kilburn, after Kilburn High Road, little community centre back at Kingsdown Road. It used to be on a Tuesday afternoon. And I walked in there, the meeting had started, there were loads of people around the table, and that was it, you know. I said, I must, you know, they, the newcomer's time, so of course I seized the moment, and as you do, splurted some, no doubt, so a load of insanity, and that was it. I was on board, and the next meeting I went to was the Wednesday, Hampstead Heroes, and kept going, but kept using, kept going. And in 93, somebody made a suggestion from Hampstead Heroes that maybe it would be a good idea to go into treatment. And again, it was a phone call, somebody in the fellowship, somebody sponsor, and off I went, and I went and ended up north, as Gary knows, in a little draconian place up north, and I got there, and I quickly come to understand that I knew more than most of the other people in there. Because I'd been to NA meetings, you know, I had a wealth of experience, you know, I'd done 6 months of meetings, you know, so I was going to pass that on to my colleagues, plus I'd worked in two treatment facilities, so I knew the dynamics of treatment facilities, I knew what they did in the back room, and before you knew it, I had a nice little troop of negative supporters who were on my side. we was causing anarchy, you know. And the staff got wise of it, and they called a house meeting, and they says, you know, in or out, and you know, I shit myself because I had nowhere to go. You know, if I was out of there, I was done. I couldn't afford to go back to London. I couldn't afford to go back, and I suppose that was the beginning for me, kind of getting to understand about being honest. And I remember it was my first actual act of honesty, which was it was one of those Saturday. You know, Saturday haunts, you go out of treatment, you got your two or three, you go out together, you know, and you go off and you stay close to each other and you kind of watch each other. Anyway, this guy was adamant that he wanted to buy this book, you know, and it was a no-no book. It wasn't a naughty book, it wasn't a porny book, it was a book on guns. And I says, oh, you got to, and he didn't want to declare it when he got back, you know, and it was me and this other person. The other person was up for colluding with him. And I said, no, man, I ain't having that, man. No way. And when we got back, I told on him, which was totally alien to tell on somebody because it was all that street stuff, that prison stuff. You're a grass, you're a wrong, and you know, this, that, and the other. But I knew if I hadn't told him, he would have declared, whether it was a week or two weeks later, and I would have been out on me ear. And I couldn't afford to be out on me ear. You know, and that was the first time that, as long as I can remember, I got honest about something. And it was the beginning for me. You know, I completed that place, and I did, you know, they get you to do 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, shared some stuff with some guy, which was, again, a really weird thing. They got this guy, and I did this step 5, and this guy came in and sat and talked with him, and I found out that he was a little bit around the same age as me. He was actually from Birmingham, and he was brought up in the same area and went to the same school as me, which was really weird. Anyway, I can't remember what I told him. Who knows what I told him? You know, I did my best at that point in time, sharing the step 5 that I shared with him. And often I came back to London, and I suppose that's where my, again, another monumental, you know, I came to a place down in South London, which used to be a real nice, well, it used to be a beautiful place. It probably still is. It's not for men anymore. Now it's for women, for those who know it. But it was for men back in the day, and it was like, the staff there was like, you had your mum. The guy who ran it was like dad. The woman who was in second was like mum, and then the woman who did the admin, both of them in the fellowship, was like auntie, you know, and it was like having a family, you know, and there was lots of hoorah-y fellas in there as well, which was great. There was hoorah-y fellas, and there were a lot of South London, all right, mate, going to sort you, you know, ticket tout kind of posse, and it was because they all went out on a Friday Saturday night doing tickets. I went out doing posters, they went out doing tickets, and you had the hoorah kind of posse who were, I don't know what they were doing, but they, you know. but the South London guys used to get the jib with the hoorahs, and it, again, another monumental moment for me was we had a house meeting, and somebody had done something nasty to one of the hoorahs. He decided to wipe his arse on one of their towels, and, you know, which is, you know, it goes on and that stuff. And I kind of stood up and I said, look, this ain't acceptable, and whoever's done it needs to step up, you know. Which again was alien for me, because to put my head above the parapet and you know, and defend, you know, but always inside me, that was always something that was inside me, injustice, and it's still with me today. You know, as soon as I get a sense of injustice, you know, the blood starts to bubble, and I want to kind of fight for the underdog, and that's what I say. And I think that, you know, in recovery we have these. We have these moments in our recovery which are really significant, and it's nice to remember them, and they kind of spur us along, you know, because there's other times, I know in my recovery and I hear other people share, when we have low points, you know, where we have low points where things are not going our way, where we're not feeling particularly good, or we might get ill health, or who knows, you know, life is life when we come in, and life doesn't always deal us the hand that we'd like it to deal us, and it's good to have memories where, you know, we found courage, we found strength, whether we had a higher power at that point in time or whether we had a connection, because I don't think I particularly did have at that point. I wasn't au fait with the program in any shape or form, really. You know, my story is that I left there and got very busy in the fellowship, and I used to be known as Rasta John then, because there weren't many black people in the fellowship, and I was a bit of a novelty because I had dreadlocks, and you know, and that paid to my advantage, especially where the fairer sex were concerned. So, you know. But within a very short period of time, I got myself into trouble, you know. And my sponsor suggested that I should stay away from the fairer sex and have myself some abstinence from that. And for the first time in my life, apart from being in jail, I did, you know, followed my sponsor's direction, and I did. I went 18 months abstinent without a woman in my life. That was amazing. You know. So I got busy in the fellowship and got convention committee, did the London Convention Committee, and, you know, for people who've heard me share before, that didn't work out too well because I ended up stealing money from the London Convention Committee. I ended up becoming treasurer of the London Convention. I was about 4 years clean, you know, I remember going to area to be ratified, and to region to be ratified. And they ask you all these questions about your financial stuff. And the fact was, I wasn't skint. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that I was sat in a room with, I mean, thousands of pounds. Because, of course, we weren't that tight as we are now. We've developed, we've matured, we've grown as a fellowship. We wasn't as tight as back then. And I had thousands of pounds. And just my disease says, well, come on, man. You know, they're not paying you. You deserve a little something, you know. You know, that voice you were talking about, you know, that it said, and you know, and I ended up putting some of that money in my pocket, you know, and that was part of my downfall. The dishonesty had crept in a little while before that. I relapsed when I was like 5 years and 2 months. I'd say the process started around about 3.5 years in, when I was about three and a half. So it took a good 18 months before I picked up that pipe. But there was lots of shady stuff that went on around that time. Because I didn't have the capacity to kind of embrace the program. I didn't have the capacity to let my sponsor in, to open up and to be... and just to open up, really. I can't say be real, just to open up. I didn't have that. You know, intimacy was wasn't a concept that I'd had any education around.
Oh, no, it's fine.
Got me worried then. and it was real painful, you know, real painful place to be. You know, I didn't want to be where I was, and I didn't want to do what I did, but I did. And I don't know what to say, because it's a dark time. It's a dark time, you know, and I can go back to why that is, you know, like you shared, the upbringing, and, you know, I was abandoned at birth, adopted, you know, not treated particularly well, you know, and I always had this thing that I was never, ever allowed to make any decisions. So that same scenario, being stuck in that room with that money, was just like when my mum and dad went out and they left me on my own with my sister. And guarantee, when they left me alone, I'd mess up. I'd do something that I shouldn't do. And it's just kind of reliving that stuff. Because I hadn't resolved. I hadn't worked on myself and I hadn't resolved. And I can look at that in hindsight, but back then I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what was going on. I can look at that in hindsight. Having worked the steps, having done some work on myself, having learned to be able to open up and let people in, you know, it's a funny old process, man. You know, and I think in NA, you know, it's great to have clean time, and I love my clean time. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, I've been recovering since 1989, and there ain't a day in that from 1989 that ain't any less value than the days I have today with my X amount of clean years, because it's all part of the same process. You know, I mean, you know, we celebrate recovery and that's great, and we celebrate clean time. That's good too. But what I've learned is that my recovery is you know, you can't recover if you haven't got clean time. You need clean time to recover. That is the bottom line. You know, but I cannot hang my hat on my clean time. You know, I can't hang it on there. You know, I have to hang it on my recovery, and I have to recover a day at a time. You know, so what happened was people made suggestions. People came and back, you know, that thing you're using, you know, and NA members start bugging. And I had a flat in Tufnell Park, and it was on the ground floor. It wasn't on the second or the third floor. And what a curse, because I'd be using, and the phone would be ringing, people banging on the window. Of course, you know, I'm a crack smoker, you know, so anybody who bangs on my window, you know where I'm going, you know. So that was, you know, it's crazy, isn't it? I was in pain, so I thought my remedy for my pain is to smoke crack. Is that insane or what? You know, crack for me is one of the most punishing drugs you can use. It promises you everything and delivers you nothing. And again, that tied in with my abandonment. You know, I can abandon myself. I could abandon myself at the drop of a hat. And when I looked at my life and did an overview, you know, I've been educated, I've been employed, I have families, I've had business. And every one of those situations, I've abandoned. You know, and because, you know, we are what we are, aren't we? You know, and that's what my life was about abandonment. So people drew me back into the fellowship. I mean, I used to go to meetings intermittently in that, it's a 3-month period I kind of used over, and a month of that I went off to some retreat in Ireland because I got family who live in a retreat. So the months either side, people would pester me, and I still go to meetings, and people say the most wonderful things to me. It's good you've come back, really good, we miss you. Oh, what a... And then somebody would say something like, I didn't think you'd use, and I'd just be floored. All the other stuff would just go out the window, you know. Didn't expect you to do that. And I just, that'd be me gone again for a period of time. And so we have to be really careful what we say to people when they come back. We do. You know, we might not think we're doing any harm, but we're really fragile. You know, coming back from a relapse is really fragile. And when you've had time in this program, shame, guilt, remorse, it's really, and pride, really difficult to overcome. Because that disease tells you, what's the point, mate? What's the point? You've clocked up yours. You've given it a go. What's the point? Forget it. You ain't never going to get it again. You ain't worth it, so forget it. You know. So it's really, 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 really need to nurture people. Really need to love people and really support them when they come back through the door. And of course, it's not always easy, because sometimes we're full of our own stuff and we're not on our game. And sometimes things come out of our mouth that we don't know. Thanks. You know, so from there... You know, someone suggested maybe it would be a good idea if I moved to Western Supermere. And I remember this guy coming around, and he said to me, he's a black guy, and he came around, with his partner, who was a good friend of mine, and says, I suggest you go to Western Supermere for 7 years. He says, I, like you, was a crack user, and I've been in Western Supermere for 7 years, and I'm 7 years clean. I looked at him like, what the? 7 years? So anyway, I went off to treatments and didn't even last 7 months, and I was back in London. You know, I came back, and of course, you know, that thing, you know, he's 7 years clean, he's got some wisdom. He's a crack user like me, he's got some wisdom. You know, he's got some experience. Did I listen to that? No. What did I do when I come back? I used. You know, and I went back, and I came back, and I used again, and then I went back. And so between... whenever, May and January, the majority of the time I was clean, but I came back, every time I came back to London I used. And by January 1999, I give it up, because the woman I was with kicked me out. That was the bottom line. She kicked me out, she said, look, you got to go, end of, can't take any more. She was in recovery too, and that's it. And I was living in Bristol with her then, and she says, you got to go to Western Supermere, there's a guy down there who'll help you. And it really felt like it was the end of the world. It was, you know, you couldn't go any further. That if you get to Western Supermere, you're going to kind of drop off and there'll be nothing there. And it just felt like the end. And I ended up in a dry house, and they put me in this room, and there was a television and two single beds and a wardrobe. And I cried my eyes out. I got a nice plush apartment in Tufnell Park, kitted out, good to go, but I can't go anywhere near his, because any time I go near his, I use. And I surrendered. I suppose that was a moment, an epiphany, you know. I surrendered. And there I was. I was in Western Supermare. And I beat the 7 years. I stayed there 13. 13 years. But, you know, the process started for me there. You know, I'd had an experience with the steps. I'd had experience with sponsors. I'd had experience with service. You know, I'd experience with meetings. So I had experience, you know. And when I got there, there was only 3 meetings a week. And we used to have to shuffle between the other fellowship. So we'd do 3 meetings and 4 meetings in the other fellowship. You didn't have any choice. You had to do, you know, you want to do 90 meetings in 90 days. That's what you had to do. And that's what we did. And slowly but surely, we kind of got a meeting every day going. And then we got a lot of the meetings. There's two meetings a day. And it's a thriving fellowship down there. I got myself a sponsor. You know, a little short guy. Not a designer stitch to his name. I can't even remember ever asking him. But somehow he became my sponsor. He had the measure of me from the off, you know, and suggested, you know, he hadn't worked the green and gold, but he took me through the green and gold. And step by step, not even step by step, paragraph by paragraph. He worked out that I was academically, I was okay. I could write it out, man. I could scribe it out, you know. I could give it you, blah, 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 blah. No problem. Feel it. Didn't know how to do that, and that's the work he did with me. You know, I had to kind of internalize that stuff and feel it. What was it? You know, I really needed to find out. Like it says in step 5, what is the exact nature? You know, what is the exact nature? You know, if I don't know the exact nature, I can't move on to step 6 and step 7. And if I can't do step 6 and step 7, I can't do step 8 and step 9. Because if I don't know what my exact nature is, how can I go and say sorry to people? How can I make a list for starters, you know? And then again, going back to 6 and 7, I don't have a God in my life. You know, a loving God. I haven't got that relationship. I haven't surrendered yet again to that loving force that I brought into my life in step 2, made a decision in step 3, you know, to pray. And say too that I'm entirely ready to have my defects of character removed. You know. And I humbly ask for my shortcomings to be removed. And I'm kind of stuck there at the moment as things would have to, you know, as we do. You know. I mean, my life has changed and I went to McDonald's, had a burger, and read step 7. I haven't read step 7 for a while. But I'm a bit stuck in particular areas of my life, especially relationships, as some people may know. I get myself into relationships with people I shouldn't be in relationships with. I had a relationship with a woman for the past 5 years who's a married woman, you know. And my justification is, well, she doesn't sleep with her husband. That's my disease, you know. She doesn't sleep with her husband. She lives under the same, but she doesn't sleep, you know. So I kind of justify that stuff, you know, and that's painful moving away from that. It was painful being in it, but my denial is that strong that I can say, well, it's not my problem. I'm not married to a husband, you know, so it's not my problem. But of course it's my problem. It affects my recovery. It affects my spiritual development. It affected her spiritual development, and I was involved in her downfall, in her not being able to grow spiritually because I'm in a relationship. I'm colluding with her. And it's real painful to admit that stuff. And now I'm in a relationship with another woman who's as crazy as a coot. She's in recovery. I'm running around chasing her like she's the last thing on the planet. You know. My sponsor says to me, why? And I say, I don't even know why. You know, she's just that flavour that taps into my flavour. You know. But it's painful. It is painful, man. You know. You know, I'm coming on 14 years clean and I'm running around after somebody who's 3 years clean, you know. Because when I was 3 years clean, I was crazy. I'm running around someone who's 3 years clean, expecting her to respond to me like she's 10, 12 years clean. You know, you can only get so much juice out of an apple. You know. You know, and... It's painful, man. Painful. You know. So don't get me wrong. I can identify it. I see it. I know it. That don't mean I'm going to stop it. That don't mean I'm going to leave here and not do it tomorrow or even tonight. You know, I'll probably be texting her and phoning her. You know. And I heard Anthony share about this a long time ago, and it's applicable to me. I'm a crumbs merchant. Throw me some crumbs and I'm there. You know. Because there's still part of me that's working on the intimacy stuff. You know, I love a woman who's unavailable. I love a woman that's not available. Because I fear a woman who is available. Give me a woman who's available and I'm worried. You know, but I'm working on that stuff, man. You know, I'm working on that stuff. And you know, if you're new around, you know, it's never a done deal. Because something will come, the disease of addiction will come around and smack you in the back of the head with something, you know. And that's why this program talks about maintaining our spiritual condition on a daily basis. And we, you know, and maintaining our spiritual condition on a daily basis takes work. Because there's so many other things that come into our life on a daily basis. Whether it's a relationship, whether it's a job, whether it's a house, whether it's, you know, whether whatever it is. There's lots of things that will detract us from maintaining our spiritual condition. You know, and, I do maintain my spiritual condition. I meditate, I pray, but sometimes I don't step, you know, sometimes when I need to step up the game, I don't step it up enough, you know, and when I don't step it up enough, the disease of addiction plus my ego kind of can back me in a corner and I can be doing stuff that's not particularly good for me. And if it's not good for me, then it's not good for my sponsees, it's not good for my children, it's not good for anybody in my life, because if I'm not centered and present, then I'm not going to be the best person the loving God that's in my life allows me to be. And I'll finish with this. I've just moved from Western Superman. I've just moved up to Birmingham. If you get the opportunity to come to Birmingham, or you want to come to Birmingham to share, please, please do. Please invite yourself. We don't care. If you feel you've got a message to carry, we'll have you. We'll have you. And I've moved up there, and it's probably, it's a real loving fellowship. I can't say it's the most loving fellowship in the world, but it's a real loving fellowship. And it's, you know, what I couldn't do for myself, God has done for me. And it's invited me and allowed me to be amongst people. I've never experienced it. I didn't experience that in Western, but I'm experiencing it in Birmingham. A loving fellowship that's really supportive, and they care for each other. And they don't gossip about each other. And they don't bitch about each other, you know, which is so refreshing, you know. So if you want to come up, you want to share, you know, take my number and you can come up. And if you're new around, keep coming back. This is the place to be. Thanks for letting me share. Thanks.